I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Hello, I'm Farah Khan. This is Prof Talk. On today's show, I interview Keith Millard from the UBC Creative Writing Department. Keith Millard is not only an internationally acclaimed writer and novelist specializing in fiction and poetry, he also chairs one of North America's most successful creative writing programs. Professor Millard was born in Wheeling, West Virginia. He immigrated to Canada in 1970, and after a brief period in Alert Bay, he settled in Vancouver. In the early 1970s, he worked as a freelancer for CBC Radio and also co-founded the Federation of BC Writers. In 1989, he became an assistant professor at UBC. After publishing 14 novels, including one book of poetry, developing literary genres of magic realism, and experimenting with the complexities of gender in fiction, Keith Millard continues to work with new genres in literature. One might say his best work is yet to come. You are listening to Prof Talk. Well, welcome, Professor Millard, to the show.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you. You're an accomplished writer, a novelist. You've taught at UBC for 20 years. You know, we're here to talk about not just what you've written in the past, but also what you're currently writing right now and what you're currently doing. Can you give us a snapshot of say, the last 20 years at UBC, what you've been up to?
My last 20 years at UBC, good heavens. I'm not sure you have enough time. I've taught every genre in creative writing except for stage play, about which I know absolutely nothing. Except I go to Bart on the Beach every summer, and that's as much as I know about stage writing. But I've taught all the other genres. I've published, I always forget, 14 books. One is a book of poetry. The rest are novels. I've written personal essays and various other kinds of nonfiction pieces over the years for various magazines, varying from things like Canadian Literature to Flair, in which I had an article once many years ago.
And so what are you doing at the moment? Are you busy? Yeah, because I know you're chair of the Creative Writing Department, but are you also writing more? Because after 14 novels and works of fiction and poetry, are you still going?
I am certainly still going. In fact, in some ways, I feel almost possessed at the moment because I have so many things going on in my creative life. I'm most of the way through a memoir, which I've found very hard to write because I thought it was going to be easy. Just write about yourself, okay? But the hard part about writing memoir, if you've been a fiction writer, is that you can't make anything up. And about 400 million times, I'll stop with my fingers poised above the computer keys and say, you can't say that. You just made it up. Because in fiction, what happens is you'll start with a germ of something, and you can follow the feeling of it, or the way it would go, or the way it might go. But when you're writing about your own life, you're supposed to be telling us what actually happened, at least as best as you can remember it. So the memoir will be finished and published next year, I hope. I have another novel on the back burner, which, unlike many of my earlier ones, is actually set right here in BC. It's set in West Vancouver, where I live, and is set in the present. And was inspired, I think, by my two daughters. And, you know, I've been watching them grow up and thinking, gee, that whole milieu that they move through is really fascinating, and I found myself beginning to write a novel about it. Well, actually, what happened was, as this happens to me a lot, some of the characters from the novel began to talk to me. And I could have just said, go away. You know, this is, you know, what are you doing? But I didn't. And this was a set of twins who are 12 years old and live in West Vancouver. And they began talking to me in my mind. And eventually I just sat down. This came completely out of nowhere. I had not planned it. I sat down and began to write what they were saying. And they were writing a letter to a twin studies program at some place that looks a lot like UBC. And it starts out, "Dear Twin Studies Program, we would very much like to be in your twin study," right? And it goes on from there. So I have that novel I'm working on. And then the other interesting thing is, and again, this took me totally by surprise. We have just started offering in creative writing new media and graphic novel, about which I knew absolutely zero, nothing, zip. And so I thought, I'm coming in as chair of the program. I better learn something about what this stuff means. So I went to the Crazy Show at the Vancouver Art Gallery, which was a wonderful show, by the way, where you could spend your entire day if you felt like it. But I didn't have, you know, I spent several hours in there, and I bought a few books and read them. And I thought, well, I think I'm going to survey graphic novels. So I'll start with Japan. Everybody seems to be interested in Japanese manga. So I read a bit about it, and I read a few of them, and then I got focused more and more, and I got very attracted into the genre for girls called shoujo manga, and I haven't come out yet. I have read 150 zillion volumes of this stuff, and I'm still not absolutely sure why I find it so fascinating. They have long, circular, rather drifty plots, which you would expect to go with a form that is published in volumes, in installments, and the point is to get your readership hooked so that they go and buy the next volume, so you have a job for several years turning these volumes out, and some of the stories will go as many as, you know, 12, 14, 18, 26 volumes, like Banana Fish, which is a famous one, I think went 26 volumes. And these are stories, they're comic books. These are stories written for girls. And it's a broad genre because the youngest readership is probably, you know, just able to read, 6 or 7 or 8 maybe. And, you know, they would read something like Sugar, Sugar, Rune, which is about two little witches named Chocolate and Vanilla, which I find breaks my cute dial. I can't get, you know, I can't go that cute. You know, that's too cute for me. And then at the top end are stories like Nana, which is about two teenage girls that just get out of high school. And in the first volume of Nana, they actually have their first sexual experiences right there on the page, right, you know, right in front of your eyes. So, that's the whole range of the genre. But I think what appeals to me, there are a number of things that appeal to me. One is that they are based largely on relationships. There are plots, certainly, and some of them very strong. But the main thing going on are relationships between people. And pages and pages and pages will go by devoted to that. And I found that very appealing. And not to go on forever, but the other thing I find very appealing about this particular genre is the flexibility with which they treat gender. This goes back to the originators, a generation of women manga artists that were born about 1949, so they were called the Fabulous 49ers, and they began to move into what was previously an all-male field to write directly for girls. And even in that earliest stuff, there are they're playing around with gender. In Hagio Moto's really famous one, which I think is called We Are 11, there's a character in there that you absolutely cannot tell what gender it is, right? It looks like a girl and insists it's a boy, but they're on a spaceship, and it finally turns out that they're from a particular species that doesn't really decide their gender until they're, you know, ready to get married.
Interesting.
And so I got bitten by this bug, and I'm in the process of writing one of these myself. I don't know if I'll ever find an artist who wants to illustrate it or a publisher, but I got drawn into that one. And the other thing before I leave graphic novels behind is one of the things that really struck me reading good manga and good graphic novels is how movie-like it is. And the best ones work really hard with the visual statements. There's little text, a lot of visual statements. The really big climactic moments are always told visually. And I thought, hey, this looks like a screenplay. And lo and behold, I had a thriller that I wrote as a screenplay 20 years ago. And I got that out and looked at it, and I thought, gee, the structure is beautiful to this thing. Everything's outdated. It's 20 years old. But what if I changed this, and what if I changed that, and what if it was a comic book? What if it was a graphic novel? So I've been doing that, too. So those are the projects I'm working on. I have a nonfiction book on gender, although I don't know what it's going to say, and I haven't got much of it. It's mainly notes. And I've got some poems I'm working on, too. And so this is a very productive time for me, despite the fact that I'm an administrator at the moment. That was a long... Did you want that long an answer?
No, that's great. Well, it's very interesting because it is very... What you're doing right now is very different than what you have written in the past. And especially, the setting of your new work being in West Vancouver that you mentioned. Most of your works, most recent works anyway, novels have been set in the United States. And then now with this Japanese literature interest, I think that's quite fascinating.
Well, it fascinates me, too. I sometimes wonder about my own mind and what it does. Yes, I wrote a whole series of novels set in a town I made up in West Virginia called Raysburg. I am from West Virginia. I have dual citizenship. I'm both a Canadian and an American. I actually have both passports. I have both a Canadian and an American passport. When I got them both, I put them down on the desk and looked at them, and it looks illegal, but it's not. It's perfectly legal. So
now, do you feel more Canadian or more American? Because you have now, how many years did you spend in the United States before you immigrated?
I've lived in Canada longer than I've lived in the United States, and I feel more Canadian than I do American. I still have an American accent, as you can
You do,
hear.
Yeah.
I feel very much at home in the state of West Virginia, where I was born and grew up. I love going back there. The rest of the states I feel somewhat alienated from, but West Virginia I have a strong connection to. But I am much more Canadian than I am American.
How do you react when some of your critics say that you are one of the great American novelists of this time? And you're very Canadian.
Well, if somebody wants to call me a great American novelist, they're welcome to do that. A number of my books are set in the States. Kirkus Review, I think it was Kirkus. It was one of the Library Journal reviews said about the clarinet polka. It was a very short review, and then it said, Millard is a national treasure. And I thought, my God, what a weird thing to say about a guy who has not lived in the United States since 1970.
Look, I'm just reading a couple here. Oh, oddly enough, this expatriate might have written the great American novel, and this was about your novel, or your series of novels titled The Difficulty at the Beginning. That was the Owen Sound Sun-Times. You've also... I read a number of places, actually, when I researched your background that you've entitled that, and I think that's quite fascinating. Also, I think a lot of your previous novels, especially the fact that many of them are set in the 1960s, echo a lot of sort of Joan Didion, Sylvia Plath, Tom Pynchon, and also especially the way you've worked with gender and as a genre in many of your novels.
I'm very much a... I mean, we're all marked by our generation, and I'm very much the 60s Vietnam generation. I didn't come to Canada to avoid the draft because I'd already convinced my draft board that I was unfit to serve, but I came to Canada right after Kent State because I had been very active in the anti-war movement in Boston for a couple years, and I was... burnt out and paranoid, and, you know, it was a very difficult time. If you want to see how difficult, read my book called Looking Good, which is set in Boston in the late 60s, although the character in there is not me. I think I've given the reader a good picture of the time. But I was standing in a lineup in a bank in Harvard Square, and there was two perfectly nice-looking middle-aged women in front of me, and they were talking about Kent State, and one of them said, "Those students got exactly what they deserved." And I thought, gee, I think it's time to leave this insane country. And when I first came to Canada, the first, you know, from quite a few years, especially when I moved to Vancouver, I intentionally avoided hanging out with Americans. I said, "I am Canadian, I am going to live in Canada, and I'm going to hang out with Canadians." And I learned all about Canada by listening to the Peter Rosowski show in the morning. And they used to have people on there talking about great Canadian books, and I dutifully went and read them all. So I was reading, Marie Claire Blay and Hugh McLennan and the people that we were told to read. Sheila Watson, I went and read The Double Hook, I mean, whatever they were discussing, you know. And I read Pierre Burton. And and then as soon as I could, I applied for Canadian citizenship and got it. And there was a lovely ceremony in which the ladies from the IODE, the Daughters of the Empire, and they were all very nice little old ladies. They came and pinned a maple leaf on my lapel. And my friends gave me a toy beaver, which many years later I gave to my daughter. There was a long stretch of time in which I really didn't pay any attention to the United States. I really did not think about it. It was that insane nation to the south of us. Now, that didn't stop me from setting novels down there. But you'll note, if you look at my early Raysberg books, they're all set in the past. Mm-hmm. They're set in a West Virginia that I remember.
Exactly, yeah. In the 50s
and the 60s, essentially. The 50s and the 60s, yeah.
Now, with the recent election in the United States, and I've heard this just talking from some expatriates, you know, like yourself, feeling this sort of renewed connection again to America, or this sort of hopeful feeling that things are going to change. Do you feel any sense of that, or did you feel any?
Absolutely.
Did you cast your vote?
I didn't.
Okay.
I could have. I could have registered had I done it in time and voted. And as often happens with me, some other part of my mind makes the decision for me, because I never quite got around to it. And then I ask myself, gee, what was I doing by not bothering to do that? And then I thought, it's almost as though I'm saying, okay, we'll see. We'll see. I'm still not a part of that.
Right.
I'm a Canadian. I'm not a part of that.
Well, that's kind of your answer right there, that you feel more Canadian.
I do feel more Canadian. The night that Obama made his acceptance speech, however, I sat there and cried, and I realized that it's the first time I felt really genuinely positive about the United States in well over 30 years. And I thought, you know, there is some hope down there again.
It was pretty incredible, wasn't it? Especially that last metaphor he used about those woman that was 100 and some years old.
That's right.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
So we'll see. It's hard. Well, you can imagine if you've got the Titanic going full speed ahead toward the iceberg, and if you change captains, it's very hard for the new captain to turn the Titanic around. Mm-hmm. So I wish Obama all the best, and I hope he has good people around him, but he's got a hell of a job in front of him, especially with the economic meltdown.
Now, I'd like to talk about one of your novels that you have said is very autobiographical, your novel Gloria. Can you tell us about that novel and why it is autobiographical?
Yeah, I can remember saying that to a very startled interviewer, because Gloria is about a country club girl in the 1950s. It's autobiographical in the sense that Gloria has a big chunk of my intellectual life. I mean, my personal life, I mean, I did not grow up as a girl in a country club. My personal life is nothing like Gloria's, nor has my experience anything like Gloria's, but there's some part of her that is, you know, I put a huge chunk of myself into. It was very funny when HarperCollins published it in Canada. I had just been assigned a new editor as we were approaching publication. And she said to me, as editors often do, and they should know better dealing with crazy writers, she said, if you had to summarize in just a word or two or a sentence what Gloria was about, what would you say? And I said, Gloria's about consciousness. And there was the world's longest pause on the phone line. But that is always the way I've thought about that book. It is about someone constructing the world, about, you know, what it means to be conscious and conscious of other people and of being in the world. Now, a whole lot goes on in Gloria. It's the summer of 1957. Gloria's just graduated from this little college, and she's been accepted to go to Columbia in the fall and study with Lionel Trilling, which she badly wants to do because she's a great student of English literature, very bright girl. And everybody in 1957 is telling her, oh, Gloria, you don't want to go off to graduate school. You want to get married. You want to find the nice boy and get married. And there's even the nice boy there in the story. He's all waiting to marry her. And, you know, and Gloria is a long book. It's 665 pages long. It took me 8 years to write it. I did massive amounts of research. I went and dug out and was also helped by UBC Interlibrary Loans. God bless them. They're wonderful. Who found for me the most obscure and strange things that I continually ask for. But I went back and read masses of stuff. All these advice books that came out in the 50s on how to be a girl, how to be a girl books. There was a zillion of them. They weren't called that. But, you know, I read a lot of them. I read magazines from the time. I read home economics texts and various things like that. I found a wonderful book that listed every novel with adolescent protagonists in it published from the 40s through the end of the 50s. And I went through and read all of them that had a female protagonist in an urban setting. So I did this huge amount of stuff. And all the time I was reading, I did this thing that I think writers should do, that I tell my students to do, that I do over and over again. I didn't read this in a detached way. I read this and I said, I am 15 years old. I am female. And this is my time, and I'm reading this for somebody to tell me how to live my life. In other words, I tried to put myself into that mental space.
Is that what you might have, because I know you've termed this in past sort of what might be called truth in fiction?
Yes. Yeah.
And that's where you see that as, you know, of really paramount importance in your writing.
Yeah, well, I have been... Now, writing comic books at the moment, I'm not, but I have been up until now, with the exception of Two Strand River, a realist. Realism is something I take very seriously, and for me, that means that I want my fiction absolutely grounded, dead grounded in social, economic reality insofar as I can construe it, right? I would like my books set in the past to be so well researched that you could use them to teach in a history course, right? Now, you don't always succeed, but at least that's the goal I'm aimed at.
Now, can you tell us a little bit about the creative writing department, because it is a very unique department on campus, also about your role as chair, and also about sort of your future in that department, because you have been here for 20 years. Are you going to keep going?
I'm going to keep going for a few more years. The creative writing department started in a legendary time. We all have myths about our origins. Our creation myth is that, and, you know, it's based on truth. Earl Burney, the great Canadian poet, was in the English department. And there was a great professor in the English department, and he and Earl hated each other and did not get along. And Earl said, "We need a place for the poet naked in academe. We need our own department." And he pulled out of the English department and founded the creative writing department, and has been going ever since. Was an independent department for a long time. Then for a while it was part of theater and film, and now it's an independent program, having the same status as a program as Women's Studies and First Nations Studies at UBC. We have a long, venerable history. Many, many famous writers have passed through our program. And we like to think, and I think with a lot of evidence to support us, that we are the premier creative writing program in North America. Wow. So what are we doing? We have always taught the, you know, core bread and butter disciplines, fiction, nonfiction, poetry. We added children's writing maybe 25 years ago, so we teach children's writing. We've recently, as I said earlier, added graphic novel. We'll see how that goes. There seems to be a lot of student interest in that. And we have a three-credit course on new media. That is the first time we're going to see how that goes, which led me to talk to some wonderful people from the games industry. And I hadn't realized that writing for games was so complicated, because not only do you have to worry about your plot and a three-act structure, but you have to worry about your player of the game wandering off from the central plot. So you have things called choke points to pull them back into your central plot. Otherwise, they would never get through the game. So we have a lot of, I think, new and exciting things. And we're still offering the same good old courses in fiction and poetry and nonfiction. And
well, it has been a pleasure to have you on the show, and I look forward to other writers from your department on our show.
Well, I'm sure they'd love to be here too, and it's been great talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You know, it's darkest before the dawn. This thought keeps me moving on. Through all this world of joy and sorrow, we still can have singing tomorrows. Through all this world of joy and sorrow, we still can have singing tomorrows. Some say that humankind won't long endure, but what makes them feel so doggone sure? I know that you, who hear my singing, could make those freedom bells go ringing. And so we keep on while we live, until we have no more to give. And when these fingers can strum no longer, and the old banjo to young ones stronger, and when these fingers can strum no longer, and the old banjo to young ones stronger.
Is listening to an interview with Professor Keith Millard from the UBC Creative Writing Department. In the coming months, we hope to have more writers from his department as guests in our studio. For more information on Professor Millard as well as the Creative Writing Department, you can visit www.creativewriting.ubc.ca. You are listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM. You're currently hearing the song titled Power of Song by American legend Pete Seeger, who recorded this last year at the age of 89. Pete Seeger is an American folk singer, political activist, and a key figure in the mid-20th century American folk music revival of the 1960s. We would love to hear your comments and feedback of this show, so please email us at proftalk@gmail.com. And you can also hear the podcast of this show anytime on CITR.ca. I'm Farah Khan. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye for now.
If we could heed these early warnings, the time is now, quite early morning.
Let's make rock and roll! First, we need a drummer to give us the beat. Now we need an electric bass guitar to boom out the low notes. Ah, here we go, yeah. Then we need a regular electric guitar playing some simple chords. Now we need somebody to sing the word.
We go loogie doogie sapphire.
Some adults to say, what's that noise? They call that music?
I'm getting a terrible headache.
Now we've got rock and roll.
Hey, Mama, you seen him, you dug him. Now here he is with the beat that's sweet and the jive that's alive. Your very own muchacho.
Third Time's the Charm every Tuesday morning, 9:30 to 11:30 a.m., right here on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.